Wake up, everyone. It's time for a call to action. Welcome to Call to Action Today, where there are no sacred cows, with your host, Steve Noble, just an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and he's calling you out every week to live the Christian life in your home, your work, and even in politics. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH, or check him out online at c2atoday.org. And now, with some much-needed cough medicine for the church, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Welcome to Call to Action, the Steve Noble radio show. I'm not Steve Noble. My name is Benjamin Quinn. I've been with you before several times with Steve, and the last time that I was here with you, actually, just a couple weeks ago, Steve and I swapped chairs, and he let me interview him, and now Steve is out for a couple of weeks. He's letting his voice rest. Of course, we know that Steve talks quite a bit because that's what we ask him to do, and he serves us well in that way. And he's letting his voice rest for a couple weeks. So as a reminder, first, please remember to pray for Steve, and we did so just before we got started. And then also he asked that I would remind you what's coming up tomorrow and next week is basically a best of series. Tomorrow focuses on J. Warner Wallace's book, Cold Case Christianity. And then as well next week, including Ann Graham Watts and Walt Heyer and others as well. You don't want to miss that. So again, my name is Benjamin Quinn. I teach theology and history of ideas at the college at Southeastern and Southeastern Seminary here in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And I have with me today Dr. Ant Grinham. Dr. Grinham.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
It's great to have you. You've been on the show with Steve several times before, I believe.
Yes, I have.
And I have to say, your accent is not South Georgian. Is that right?
It's South, but not South,
not
Georgia.
South Georgia.
No, I'm from the Deep South, and that's South Africa.
South Africa.
So this is a South African accent, an English-speaking South African accent.
Which immediately, the second that we hear an accent like this, as far as anyone else's perception of you, your IQ is immediately 20 points higher than anyone else in the room.
Which is totally unfair.
but it sure feels that way. So here's what we're doing today. Is just as from a couple of weeks ago when I was with Steve, I'd mentioned to him before when I was on the show with him, I said, Steve, next time that I could do the show with you, I want to trade seats and I want to interview you. And we basically called it story time with Steve. We sort of went from pagan to radio personality. How did you get there? Dr. Grinham, today we're going to do the same with you, though you're not a radio personality per se. But you do have a pretty amazing story, as I've gotten to teach with you now for several years at Southeastern. You have a pretty remarkable story, growing up in South Africa, as you did, and then coming to Christ at 18. You're going to talk about that, and then eventually becoming what you are now, an associate professor of missions and Islamic studies at one of the largest seminaries in the world. And so we're very thankful to have you. Thank you for your time. And thank you, frankly, for letting me interrogate you. We did a bit of a pre-interview yesterday to prepare for this, and I've basically asked him a million questions, and he's going to let me do it again today. So thank you.
You're most welcome. And let me say one thing here. If you are a believer in Christ, you have an amazing story. Don't think that mine's better because it's more exotic.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well said. Well, with that, Dr. Grinham, would you just take off with us? I want to use this first segment. We have four segments on the show, and I want to use this first segment basically to move from birth to conversion. So, and especially focusing in on perhaps what's most fascinating or one of the more fascinating parts of your story is that you grew up in apartheid South Africa. So can you focus in on that a bit? Give us a sense of what it was like. If we had met the boyhood or the childhood Aunt Grinham, as you were growing up primarily in the 60s, 1960s, South Africa, what was that like? And then carry us up to the point when you're converted.
That's a bunch of stuff that you've just asked there. Let me do my best here. First, my name, given name was actually Anthony. I effectively changed my name to Ant when I became a believer in Christ. With a new life came a new name. But so I was growing up with a different name. But one thing I want to say here is, I think many Americans would have been able to identify with the South Africa I grew up in, because in a way, I hate to have to say this, the policy of apartheid, which means separateness, the legal separation of the races, which unfortunately characterized South Africa for so long until 1994, was amazingly successful. Successful in a bad sense. What I mean by that is, if you were a white person growing up in South Africa, you were acutely aware of the black majority all around you, but very unaware of the kind of lives that they lived. They were on the periphery, they worked for us, but they were at a distance. And it was only much, much later that many of us discovered just some of what the horrors of apartheid entailed. So it was a privileged time to grow up, and very easy to be a white South African living in living at that time.
And you did you grow up in a Christian home there in South Africa?
I did, and I need to say something important here. My parents were converted about a year before I was born, and my mother struggled to fall pregnant, had some issues, and so they saw my coming along as a wonderful endorsement to their conversion. Now, they were Anglicans, which would be the equivalent of the Episcopalian Church here, and we need to be aware that the Anglican Church is a large room. So you have a whole lot of stuff there. You have some solid evangelical folks. You have folks who are called Anglo-Catholic, very like the Roman Catholic, some very liberal folks, and then all sorts of others besides. So you could have a variety of theological positions, and still do, in the Anglican Communion. So my parents were genuine believers, but were colored by the churches that we attended, and some of those were, if I put it bluntly, less than evangelical.
And so with the church that your parents attended, would they have considered themselves evangelical, or would they have aligned with what we tend to be sort of the basic and fundamental evangelical tenets of our faith?
The churches, no, depended a lot on the minister who was there at the time, but I would put them more towards the Anglo-Catholic / liberal side of the spectrum.
Yeah, so it was quite cultural then. In this case, especially for white South Africans to be involved in?
Yes. I'd say the majority of English-speaking South Africans at that time would have been members of some kind in the Anglican Church. It was what they would associate themselves with.
Yeah. So trying to just wrap my mind around going to church in South Africa, even in Anglican Church, and of course the Dutch Reformed community is quite large there as well. But if you're going to church in the 60s, 70s in South Africa, is it quite segregated the way that we would feel like it is now?
Absolutely. A black person wouldn't dare step in, and they would have separate services at separate times. And yes, but it's something we didn't even think about. It was just, quote, normal because that's all we knew.
So I don't want to get too far ahead of us, but so take me back then. If I run into Anthony Grenham,
yes,
in the 60s, you're running around, I assume, like most boys, 8, 9, 10, and then early teenage years. What are you like at this time?
Well, a bit of a loner because my sister and brother didn't come along until I was out of my formative years. But let me give you a little bit of a background.
Well, we'll come back to that. We've got the music playing. We'll come back. And then just as soon as we come back, want to hear especially about your conversion to Christ, and then want to hear about a little bit of your career, sort of what it's like after you get out of college. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes as soon as we return. This is the Steve Noble Show, Call to Action. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. Call to Action, the Steve Noble Radio Show. My name is Benjamin Quinn. I'm filling in for Steve today, who is out letting his voice rest. And to be clear, Steve is doing very well. In fact, just before the show, he FaceTimed me just to make sure everything was in order. And so you're aware, he FaceTimed me from a hammock somewhere around Lake Gaston. So I think he's doing just fine. So Steve, praying for you, brother. Grateful for you and look forward to having you back in the seat soon. I'm here with Dr. Ant Grenham, who teaches missions and Islamic studies at Southeastern Seminary and the College at Southeastern in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And this is story time again, much like we did with Steve just a couple of weeks ago. I asked Dr. Grenham if he would come in and just share with us his own testimony about how he was converted to Christ, his growing up in South Africa. And that's basically where we left off in the first segment. So, Dr. Grenham, take us back to teenage life a little bit and then up to conversion.
Sure. I'd like to step back a bit and just say that growing up, I was thinking very much of myself as a good little boy. And every time I heard the gospel, and it wasn't that often because I said the church itself was fairly liberal, when I did hear it, I intensely disliked it.
And why was that?
Basically they're saying that I'm not a good little boy and I'm a sinner and I had a problem. I didn't think I had a problem at all.
I think the Bible calls this a stumbling block. That's what it was supposed
Absolutely.
To be.
I went to a Presbyterian equivalent of VBS and they presented the gospel very clearly indeed. I was 8 years old. I was angry. I can still remember walking down the road home so angry. I was going to talk to my mother and she would agree with me that the Presbyterians were wrong. To my shock, she agreed with the Presbyterians.
Oh, wow.
And I decided I do not want to broach the subject again.
So the first major domestic dispute in the Greenham household between you and your parents was about the gospel.
No, I wouldn't say that.
It was a big one, but maybe not the first.
This was something where I realized I just don't want to go here because it's a very, very uncomfortable subject.
Wow. And
there were similar situations where when I heard the message about being a sinful person and not being able to manage on my own, I simply didn't like it and didn't want to go there.
Wow.
Well, one thing that all white male South Africans had to do when I was growing up is when they reached 18 was go on serve in a compulsory capacity in the military. Mm. So national service, and my time, it was a compulsory 9-month period.
Mm.
So went there, went to a place called Oudtshoorn. It's in the south of South Africa, and did my 9 months there. When I went there, I thought I was a Christian. For a very simple reason, I'd actually at that point come to an intellectual understanding that the gospel was actually correct. However, to understand something in your head and to apply it to your life are two very different things.
Yeah.
And the kind of way that things worked in the South African military, I discovered very quickly that I was nothing of the sort.
Mm.
And it was a matter of several weeks before I realized I was not a Christian. Never had been a Christian, and quite frankly, didn't really want to be a Christian. So,
really? So, yeah. So before we move on, I want to get on to some other parts of your story, but let's focus in on this part. What was it that then actually led to you really sort of being turned off by the gospel, at the same time kind of thinking that you are a Christian, some of this constellation of confusion perhaps? What is it that actually brings you to conversion?
Well, I couldn't live a Christian life without the power of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So just knowing something in your head and living it out were just two very different things. And so now the kind of way that they treated people in the military, we had a corporal who would regularly go through the bungalow, and he wouldn't use his fist on you, he'd use his elbow on you.
Mm.
And I remember once when I was manning a mortar that I preferred him to kick me than hit me because his boot was softer than his fist.
Oh, wow.
So it's just one of the small things that happen. When you have that kind of treatment, if you don't have something strong to sustain you, you're going to resort to your natural human facilities. And
yeah.
So those are not Christian ones.
It's the difficulty then of this context that actually brings you to the conversion to Christ.
Well, an important event in the army, actually. We were on maneuvers and at night, and certain guys were playing dead, and they told us, drag the dead bodies over here. So I pulled one guy across some stones and thorn bushes, and the thing is, he wasn't dead, and he objected to being dragged. And I stopped dragging him right away, but what struck me was I actually didn't care about this guy at all.
Yeah.
All I cared about was me. With a little spotlight into my heart, it showed me what I was really like, and it wasn't pretty.
Wow.
And it was that awareness that led me to do some really deep thinking and reading after I came out of my military training. I was reading C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, and he presents it so well in that book.
Mm.
And I came to the conclusion this really is true.
Yeah.
I'd love to become a true Christian, but it's simply impossible.
Yeah.
Because I will never swallow my pride.
Mm.
So it would be nice, but it's never going to happen.
And eventually?
Well, I was invited to what you might call a crusade, a rally, and a Christian meeting one evening in the City Hall in Durban, and went with a friend. And essentially, the gospel was presented that evening, but before I went, he'd been talking to me, and I felt my heart soften while he was talking to me.
Huh.
And when I was there, it was like a sense, do you want to go this new direction where your heart is softened, or do you want to resort to the default, be proud, refuse overtures that are coming your way, continue doing your own thing? And I decided, I quite like this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I repented and trusted the Lord that evening.
So to recap then, up to this point, we go from a white boy growing up in South Africa with all sort of the complicated accoutrements of
benefits.
And benefits, that's right, of apartheid South Africa. So it's not unlike, I believe you said yesterday, it's really not unlike the South in the United States around the same time.
Absolutely.
So whites on one side of the street, blacks on another, they worship in separate churches and so on. Very ugly context. And of course, it's very political. It's very complicated.
Yes.
Nevertheless, you're growing up in a somewhat Anglo-Catholic kind of context. You hear the gospel in a Presbyterian VBS of sorts, and you're furious about it. You talk to your mother. To your surprise, she agrees with the Presbyterians, and then off you go for 10 years or so, frustrated by this, thinking at one level you're a Christian, but then eventually surrendering your pride and converted to Christ.
Yes, yes.
And all the while, I suspect that you would recommend C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity to anyone listening.
To this day, no question about it.
So let me jump ahead in this segment here. Tell me a little bit. I know that following this, then you go to the University of Natal and you study, again, following your conversion, you decide to study Bible and geography.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you're teaching high school. And in this sort of next season of your life, the things that take place are that you find yourself as a high school teacher. You meet your wife, who has a fascinating story in and of herself. And then before long, you find yourself in Dallas, Texas at Criswell College with a little bit of a time working in the South African government as well. Can you just sort of drape over that quickly for us?
I'll do what I can.
Okay.
A problem with teaching religious education to guys in a white school, high schoolers, as I was doing in the 1970s, is they were forced to do this, and there was no exam, and so they had to be kept very firmly under control.
In other words, you have pagan grade schoolers, high schoolers in particular. Is it an all-guys school?
It's an all-guys school,
So pagan teenage boys who don't want to hear what you have to say.
Exactly.
And you're told to teach them Christianity.
Exactly.
It's complicated. We're going to come back. Here we are, Call to Action, the Steve Noble Radio Show. I'm Benjamin Quinn, filling in for Steve today, and we are here with you with Dr. Ant Granum. He teaches missions and Islamic studies at Southeastern Seminary and the College at Southeastern. We ended the last segment, Dr. Granum. This is story time. He's sharing with us his testimony of how he came to Christ and his personal story, which is really quite fascinating. We finished with, you have been converted to Christ, but here you are, you're teaching high schoolers during this season of your life. You're teaching high schoolers who don't want to hear anything about Christianity. You feel like you're cramming it down their throat. You also meet your wife, who's quite fascinating. She also has some time from South Africa, but she really grows up in Norway, so she's more Norwegian in her makeup than perhaps South African. You guys meet in a Bible study, I believe you said,
correct,
along the way. And then eventually, a couple of other interesting points. You spend time working for the South African government in the embassy. But then before long, you find your way to Dallas, Texas, and then back to the embassy. Can you just share that story?
That is really complicated. Let me explain it as best I can. What happened was ramming Christianity down the throats of these teenagers was really something that didn't appeal to me. I was looking for something else that I could do. At this point, it seemed like South Africa was moving in a positive direction. Mm. I wanted to be part of that. I saw an ad for junior diplomats. I applied for that, got the position, went through a year's training as a diplomat. They sent me to Israel.
Hmm.
I was there for the best part of 4 years.
Had you ever been there before?
I'd never been there before.
You didn't speak Hebrew or anything like this?
Nope. And you don't really get to speak Hebrew unless you go through an intensive Ulpan course, they call it. Be that as it may, many, many Israelis speak excellent English, so you can certainly function very well in English.
So they appreciate your accent as much as we do.
I don't know if appreciate is quite the word, but let's leave that for the time being.
Sure, sure.
And so I was there for 4 years, and what I did a lot when I was there was basically act as an apologist for South Africa, with the genuine belief that we were moving in the right direction away from apartheid.
Mm.
When I got back to South Africa, this is 1984, 1985, I realized that I'd actually been a tool of South African propaganda, and they weren't really moving seriously away from apartheid at all.
Mm.
So I felt betrayed.
Mm.
And coupled with this, there was a major development in my life. It's actually a little miracle. I had a malignant melanoma growing on the back of my ear. It was spotted just in time by our family doctor, who happened to sit behind me in church.
Oh, wow.
And he saw it, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, "I need to take this thing out." And they caught it just in time. And I'm trying to make sense of all these events. And coupled with the fact that the people that I'd known really well in Israel were Southern Baptists for the most part.
And how was that a good experience or a bad experience? I don't know whether to congratulate you or apologize.
No, that was a great experience. It's my impression that American missionaries abroad are some of the nicest people anywhere.
Oh, that's good.
And
that's
I say
fantastic.
That without any fear of contradiction.
That's fantastic.
Which is why it's such a privilege to train missionaries
sure.
just like that right now.
Sure.
Be that as it may, they were the logical people to ask for advice. Mm. And so they recommended I speak to someone called Paige Patterson, who was then president of the Criswell College in Dallas.
Okay, and why were you speaking to him? So you're thinking about a career change at this point. You're
correct,
working for the embassy,
correct.
But you realize you're basically
yeah.
being used.
I'm back in South Africa, still working for Department of Foreign Affairs, but realizing I've got some major issues here. Can I continue defending the South African government when really they don't intend moving in the kind of direction I thought they were at all?
Mm.
And I would say it was two things. It was a political concern, but also a call from God.
Mm.
And often you don't really discern how clear these things are until you look back. When you're in the middle of it, it's a lot more fuzzy
sure.
than when you look back later. Be that as it may, wrote to Dr. Patterson, long story short, whole family packed up, went to Dallas, Texas in the middle of 1986.
Well, 1986, whole family. So you're married and how many kids?
We have two children, and daughter and a son, yeah.
Okay, so you have a son and daughter and your wife, and you guys, this is not as simple as the typical sort of Bible college journey or even seminary journey. I packed up and drove a few hundred miles. I mean, this is a pretty serious commitment that you're making.
Yeah, this is about 10,000 miles.
Wow. And yeah. Okay, so you show up at Criswell College, and you're doing a master's degree in
yes.
what?
Biblical studies. So I did some prerequisites and then got the master's, MABS.
For the purpose of serving in the church, for purpose of
pastoral?
I
was really hoping to get into full-time ministry.
Okay. And then you find yourself back in South Africa, but then back doing embassy work again.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
Yeah. So essentially, ministry just didn't work out. And without getting into all the details, Dr. Patterson had some issues with the trustees at the Criswell College, and one of the steps they took was to fire all his employees. I was Dr. Patterson's intern at that time, one of a number of employees. Everyone except his secretary was fired, and I had a student visa at the time, so I had to find something else, and the most logical thing to do at that point was to go back to South Africa.
Mm.
My parents were really missing us, and it was so good family reasons to go back to.
But then you find yourself again. So you've worked for the embassy before.
Yes.
And you felt like you're being used. But now you're going to work for them again. Tell me
yes,
about that.
Something significant has happened. Nelson Mandela has been released.
Mm.
This time the South African government really is moving in a fundamentally different direction.
So you can get on board now with
yes.
the ideology and the direction
it
of
South
Africa.
It was an exciting time to rejoin. Again, I tried to get back into ministry when I was returned to South Africa. That didn't work out. And it was simply a way of the Lord nudging me back into foreign affairs.
Okay.
Wonderful time to be a South African diplomat. Basically, the whole world is saying, we want to make friends. And so, long story short, they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. So they found me and they asked me if I would open the first South African embassy ever in Amman, Jordan.
Wow. And what year is this?
This is, let's see, 1993.
We're now 1993. Nelson Mandela is out of prison.
Absolutely.
South Africa is moving in what appears to be a more positive direction.
Without question.
You have lost your job at Criswell College, Dallas, Texas. You're back in. You go back to South Africa. They rehire you. They relocate you to Amman, Jordan. You're opening up the first embassy.
Yes.
And do you see yourself in your life at this? Do you sort of reflect on life in 1993 as, I can see the hand of God here, or are you thoroughly confused?
At this point, that entire time in Dallas made no sense to me whatsoever. I just pushed it aside and assumed the Lord's purposes are mysterious. I just won't worry about it and just move on.
And how did your family respond to all this moving around?
They actually did quite well. And I think an important thing is we We prioritized our kids. We prioritized family. If you lose your family, nothing will compensate for that. So a quick word to anybody who wants to prioritize ministry or anything over family, don't do it.
Sure.
It's really, really important. That's your first important. And most important disciples are your family. We got that.
Indeed. My pastor growing up, I remember he would tell me often, he would say, Benjamin, I can always find another church, but I can't get another family.
Absolutely.
And I never forgot that. So you're back at the embassy. You're working for them again, but eventually you stop working. Tell me a little bit about that time. And also, I believe you said there was someone who was kind of after you at that point as
well. Yeah. This was a wonderful time because I learned so much about the Middle East, being in Jordan. That has certainly fed into what I'm doing now, understanding Islam so much better. Just love the Middle East to this day. Unfortunately, the ambassador that they sent after I had been there for 16 months, he and his wife didn't really appreciate the Middle East at all. Mm. Also, they'd been on the wrong side of apartheid, and I understand that they had grudges. They were convinced that we were racists and set out to prove it. And so an attempt was made to get us kicked out before our time to go. So that didn't work.
Help me understand that. So the ambassador that is sent from South Africa to be the head, of course, the head of state represented there at that embassy, you work for that person.
Correct.
But you're being accused of being a racist. Tell me, what kind of foundation do they have for these
claims?
It
was done behind the scenes. The ambassador's wife actually approached the South African Secret Service, which is the equivalent of the CIA, with a completely trumped-up story that I had opposed the new South Africa and spoken badly of Nelson Mandela. Flat-out fabrications. I never believed that there was such a thing until this actually happened to us. And all that actually was dealt with, and the way the Lord took care of that, a wonderful story on its own. I simply don't have time for that.
Sure.
But it was a realization that, unfortunately, for all my excitement with the new South Africa, and to an extent that remains to this day, I'm a fan of the new South Africa for all its problems. Mm. There just wasn't really a place for me to continue with my career with foreign affairs. So what now?
Yeah, so you're ousted, basically. I believe you said it was really the ambassador's wife that more or less shoves you out.
Yes.
And yeah, so what now? Eventually,
I got sent home in the normal way. The timing she would have liked didn't work. We did stay the extra year, which was important because my daughter finished school in Jordan. But now I'm back in South Africa, still working for the Department of Foreign Affairs. But the question is, with all my experience, all my education, what can I do? I wrote Dr. Patterson an email.
Oh, so you're following back up with Dr. Patterson.
Exactly.
Again. Okay.
And he wrote back within a week with great enthusiasm and said, why don't you come here, do a PhD, come on faculty at Southeastern.
Yeah.
I said yes.
That's fantastic. We're going to come back to that. So the first time you write Dr. Patterson is with pen and paper. The second time is an email, and you're coming back to do PhD work. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Welcome back to Call to Action, the Steve Noble Radio Show. Benjamin Quinn here with you, filling in for Steve Noble. He'll be back in a couple weeks. He's letting his voice rest, and we are here with story time, hearing the story of Dr. Ant Grenham. He teaches missions and Islamic studies at Southeastern Seminary and the College at Southeastern here in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Quickly, before Dr. Grenham, before we return to your story, a quick word about MediShare. Over $1 billion of healthcare costs shared by Christians since 1993 through the ministry of MediShare. Nearly 300,000 Christians nationwide now sharing each other's major medical expenses. Also, as Steve typically mentions, it gets you around Obamacare mandates that make you pay for things that would otherwise might violate your faith. Many Christians are saving somewhere around $500 a month or more with MediShare versus traditional health care. If you're interested, call 855-BIBLE-11. That's 855-BIBLE-11 for details. also now available in Montana. Let me return, Dr. Grinham, to you. You've been sharing with us your story. You grow up in apartheid South Africa, just serious racial issues going on, very much like what we know, what we recall in our own country, especially in the deep south of the United States. You grew up in that context. You're converted around age 18, following time in the military. You meet your wife, who's both sort of South African and Norwegian. You get married. You have family. You work for the embassy for a while for South Africa. You find yourself at Criswell College in Dallas through a series of events. You do a master's degree there, planning on pastoral ministry. You go back to South Africa. You end up working for the embassy again. You open the first embassy in Amman, Jordan, this time actually sort of confident and trustworthy about the direction of South Africa. But then the ambassador's wife ousts you in that process. You're there for 4.5 years, I believe you said?
Yes.
And the ambassador's wife decides that you are a racist. They don't want you in there. They oust you under trumped-up charges. You find yourself back in South Africa, now thinking, what do I do now? And then next thing you know, you're doing a PhD in the United States. How did we get there?
Yeah. One other thing. I wouldn't say it. She got me sent home. She attempted to, but we stayed longer than she would have liked.
Sure, sure.
And the Lord stepped in and made that possible. But that's another story for another day.
Sure, so sure. That is another story. We'll have to come back to that. But help me understand, how do you get back to the United States to do a PhD and why?
So wrote to Dr. Patterson, but why? Why? Because I was questioning, what can I do? And I've been resisting the idea of a PhD for a long time for a very simple reason. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is.
And you really need to be well motivated to embark on that kind of thing.
And how old are you at this point?
I'm in my late 40s.
So that by itself,
yes.
Folks, listen, that by itself is a testimony. You're in your late 40s, and you're and here you are married, you have two kids. You are a grown man, and you're thinking, I'm going to go back and do a PhD.
Yes.
And that's a serious commitment. Talk us through a little bit. What did the conversations with your wife look like about possibly moving back to the States and pursuing further education?
I made her a promise that I wouldn't do anything like I did back in 86 when we just left everything and went to the U.S. on faith, and there were some issues where we didn't have support. Be that as it may, I would not do that again unless there was a firm offer.
Mm.
And this time there was a very clear and firm offer from Dr. Patterson to come on faculty, do the PhD. They honored that, and I must say it's been absolutely wonderful.
And this is 2001?
This is 2001 when I came, yeah.
And you
the decision
came.
Was taken the previous year, 2000.
So 2001, you come, you start teaching and start into your PhD
yes,
program.
Yes, I taught in the college and as I did my PhD.
And you're studying Islam and world religions. Why? I can probably surmise why that might be, but why do you decide to do Islam and world religions as opposed to pastoral ministry or Bible or theology or something?
That's where my life was. I'm fascinated with the Middle East, spent a lot of time there, had real experiences with Muslims and others. Had a master's degree in biblical studies. How does this all come together? It comes together in doing Islamic studies from an evangelical Christian point of view.
And this, I suppose this is quite commensurate even now with the life that you and your wife lead. You mentioned to me yesterday that just in the past 11 months, you guys have a very global focus. And in the past 11 months, you've been on 5 continents.
That's correct. All except the one where I was born.
So you've been to almost all the continents except for Africa. Just in the last 11 months.
Exactly right.
And what is it that takes you to all these places? And tell me about that.
I had the privilege of teaching some students world religions in Brazil. And my wife joined me for a few days at the end of that. That was September last year. And then my wife's family still live in Norway, so we popped in to see them in May.
You don't just pop into Norway. I mean, that's a pretty intentional.
I know. But what we did is we got to celebrate Norwegian National Day, Constitution Day, May the 17th. The first time in almost 40 years of marriage that I've been with my wife and shared with her that extremely important day in Norway's life, Constitution Day, May 17th.
Wow.
We did that this year. We went to see our son and daughter-in-law and granddaughter in Israel, where they've been living for almost 2 years now.
And what does he do there in Israel?
He's doing a postdoc. He's studying with the University of Tel Aviv, looking into texts used by Isaac Newton.
Sure. Wow. Fascinating. And your daughter, where is she?
She's married to an astronomer living in Hawaii.
She lives in Hawaii.
Yes.
So you just popped into Hawaii as well. Why not?
We went there over the Christmas break. Yeah, but you can't have two places further apart in the Northern Hemisphere than Israel and Hawaii. They are 12 time zones apart.
That's
so
phenomenal.
If any of you are listening and you having problems with your kids taking your grandkids away, come and talk to me about my grandkids who are 12 time zones apart from each other.
Indeed.
We'll have a great conversation.
Indeed. I should put you on the phone with my parents who love to complain that we're 700 miles away and of course, we have the grandkids and so on. So take me back now. Here you are, all this amazing story of your own life, the ups and downs, the controversy, the political difficulties. But now you find yourself, you're in the United States, you're doing a doctorate, you're teaching Islam in particular and world religions. You continue to teach this,
yes,
as you train missionaries. But you're also, you're looking back now in life, whereas in 1986 and perhaps in 1993, you're looking around going, I'm not sure how I got here, and I'm not sure what the Lord's doing here. How do you look back on that now, your own history, thinking about South Africa, thinking about your time in the States, and then back to the embassy and so on? How do you view all this now in light of what you do at Southeastern?
Every one of those experiences was absolutely crucial. It's helped make me what I am today, how I understand things, how I ask questions, and how I continue to grow. I think that's really important. You were suggesting earlier that I might have some words of advice for anybody, and let me put it this way. If a day passes and I don't learn something, that's a bad day. I want to learn, and I think it's fair to say I do, learn something new every day.
Regardless of what age you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Kenneth Boer had an interesting phrase. He spoke of not hardening of the arteries, but hardening of the categories.
Oh.
Beware hardening of the categories.
Wow.
Always be open to learn new things. Of course, the truth of the gospel is absolutely central.
Yeah.
But as you cling to that, there's so many other things that are changing, different. Keep learning.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Keep asking.
Tell me this. I have several South African friends. In fact, in my own life, my own doctoral supervisor was a South African. And when he still goes back every summer. He spends his summers in South Africa and reflects on his time growing up there with great tenderness, with great sensitivity and appreciation, albeit it's complicated because of the political situation, the racism, apartheid, and so on. When you look back on it now, How do you feel about exactly where South Africa is? Especially, I'm curious about sort of the Mandela legacy, the way that we receive it. I remember asking one of my South African friends, when Mandela passed away, it was such a celebrated funeral in America, at least the way that the media played it up. But for some South Africans, it wasn't so much at all, and I was never quite sure why that is. How do you reflect on his legacy and where South Africa is now?
The first thing I need to say is the sad thing with Nelson Mandela, as best I can tell, he never became a believer in Christ. That said, he certainly practiced Christian principles. And it was that and his consistency in doing that which I think made the new South Africa possible. And a few other things here. He was president for 5 years, from 94 to 99. Then he stood down, which is a rather unusual thing in African politics. Set a great example to heads of state all over the rest of the country, and in fact many other countries in the world too, that you don't have to cling to power, step down. But then he was there, this is now 99, when he stepped down. He didn't die until 2013. So he's a living legacy for the best part of a decade and a half. And I think that had a huge impact on people as they were perhaps tempted with many of the things that African politicians are. Here's Nelson Mandela. He set a different example. One of the big things he did is he went into prison, a bitter man, angry man. He came out a changed man, not that he was a believer, but one who was forgiving, seeing things from the other guy's point of view. He even invited his jailer to his presidential inauguration. Stuff like that, which has set a wonderful example. And to a large extent, that has been what's made the new South Africa workable, even with all its problems and nonsense and corruption and economic difficulties.
Yeah. And do you get to visit South Africa often?
I haven't been back for over 5 years now, so I'm well overdue a visit. And I love visiting South Africa, don't get me wrong, but just I've been so busy having to visit all the other places that there's limits to what you can do.
So with that, as we wrap up, one final question, if you can reflect on this. If you were to talk to your younger Aunt Grinham at whatever point in your seasons of life and say, Aunt, remember this, what would you say?
Two things. Trust the Lord. He knows what he's doing. He's not going to tell you. That's why it's called trust. But trust him. But then, as you're trying to figure out what to do, always do what you know to be right in the situation in which you find yourself. As you do that, what's next will be made clear.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Graham. It's wonderful to have you. Thank you for letting me interrogate you and for sharing your story with us. And there's some parts I'd love to dig into further. Perhaps we can do that next time with another story time with you. This has been Benjamin Quinn on the Steve Noble Radio Show, Call to Action. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you tomorrow.